Hi, Niall. Welcome to another episode of In Your Nature podcast. This one could go either way. It's about species extinctions and birds that are near extinct. So we'll try keep it factual and not get too emotional about it.
Well, that'll be difficult, Ricky, because yeah, it's an emotive topic and certainly one that's close to my heart. So we'll do our very best. But just to start by saying, the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage. And this podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.
Excellent. So I think a good approach would be to talk about some species that are on the brink of disappearing in Ireland, some species that have already disappeared or are long gone, and then maybe some that have returned to sort of give a bit of an uplift towards the end. So let's try that approach.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. Always good to end on an optimistic note. And also, I think, you know, there's certainly calls for optimism and hope, even with some of the species that are on the brink, because I'm noticing in recent years there is a sea change in attitude in Ireland. There's a long way to go, certainly, but people are coming to a greater appreciation of the value of nature. I think that the COVID pandemic actually has driven people to a greater appreciation of the role of nature in their lives and the impact that we humans have on it. So maybe some of these species that are borderline now in Ireland or that appear to be on the way out, perhaps now there's the impetus among people there to try and support them and save them before it's too late. Because the nice thing about birds is it's never too late until they're actually gone. And even then there are things that can be done. I suppose a good example of that, and one that I suppose people expect us to talk about when we're talking about species on the brink, would be the curlew. It's been a real flagship species for birds on the brink and to show the declines of a once very common species. One of my favourites as well, I have to say. But it's been sad to see the decline, hasn't it, in recent years? Difficult to watch them disappear from, especially from the breeding grounds. And they're common enough birds still in the winter when you see them, although unfortunately they're declining as a winter visitor. But it's really our core breeding population that's the problem, as we've discussed before on the podcast.
Yeah, no, it is. And I can't sort of mention birds on the brink in Ireland without mentioning the BOCCI list, which stands for Birds of Conservation Concern in Ireland. And that's a list Birdwatch Ireland compiled with sort of the RSPB and others to basically flag the species that are under threat of potential disappearance within the next sort of 20 to 50 years. So if you're on the red list, there's a red and an amber list. If you're on the red list, you're getting close. Curlew are on there, corncrake are on there, ring ousel, nightjar, species like that. And if you're on the amber list, you're certainly worth watching for people like conservationists. And it's time to sort of tune into your needs and get some sort of conservation actions behind you.
It is. And again, not to be too depressing about it, but the sad fact is that if you look at the red and the amber lists, so the birds that are of immediate conservation concern and in a bad situation in Ireland, 2/3 of our bird species are on those lists now, of our regularly occurring birds, and that is shocking. And we review this list every 5 years, and every 5 years it gets worse and worse. And as you mentioned, we do this with our colleagues in the RSPB, the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds in Northern Ireland, because of course birds don't know borders, and the whole island of Ireland is one biogeographical unit. So you can't just protect birds in one of the jurisdictions on this island, you have to protect them in both, and having a joined up thinking and joined up approach is the only way to do that. So we assess those populations on an all Ireland basis, and that tells us actually a lot about the strength of some populations and unfortunately the weaknesses that others have. You mentioned one bird there that really strikes a chord with me, the ring ousel, a really wonderful bird, a bird that I'm sure a lot of listeners won't be familiar with. It's a member of the thrush family. Yeah, it's a real sort of niche species. To describe it to people, it's rather like a blackbird. Indeed, one of the old names for it is the mountain blackbird. A little larger than a blackbird, but the males have a big white crescent across their chests. And that's a good way to tell them apart from a blackbird. They also have a sort of scaly pattern down their flanks and sort of greyish streaking or patches in their wings, which are quite different from a blackbird. But other than that, it looks like a blackbird with white blotches on it. And that leads to confusion as well, because it's one of the species that's, I suppose, most often mistakenly reported to Birdwatch Ireland, because normal blackbirds do sometimes get random white patches on them due to a genetic condition called leucism. But what you get with the ring ousel, you find that usually in really remote places, high mountains, scree slopes, the areas really where blackbirds can't survive. Unfortunately, they've been prone to disturbance, and climate change seems to hit them as well. The blackbirds are now able to colonise areas where they previously couldn't, and they're pushing out their close relatives and the ring ousel. So it's been sad to see the decline of that bird. It's gone from most of the country now, sadly.
Yeah, no, they're a lovely species, and we'll listen to the audio now. And the way of surveying for them for territories and to get the number of breeding pairs, and Alan Mee, actually, who we interviewed for the species reintroductions, he's heavily involved in ring ousel monitoring in Ireland. And you're listening out in these huge valleys for quite a vague little song from an individual male bird, and let's play that now.
I remember hearing that song many, many years ago with my late father in the valley at Glenmalure in County Wicklow. And it must have been, I suppose, one of the last of the species occurring in Wicklow. They used to breed there quite commonly up on the Scree slopes. It took me ages to find it. And eventually with a telescope, I could see it just on a low rock on the top of a ridge up on the Scree slope. And there's no way that a human being could have got within, I would say, 500 metres of that bird. Completely inhospitable terrain. If you tried to climb up that Scree slope, it would collapse down. You'd fall. And the area where these birds occur, they really are inhospitable and hard to survey, which is why it's so difficult to assess the population of them, but also why maybe we can hold out a bit of hope that perhaps in some unsurveyed valleys in places like Kerry and Donegal, they may still be clinging on.
Absolutely, yeah, fingers crossed. And I know they're repeating the survey this year in many of their strongholds, so hopefully there'll be some positive news out of that in the autumn. Another really unusual bird that people may have heard the audio from in maybe Midsummer Murders or some English thing like that is the nightjar, a really unusual bird.
It is, absolutely. Unusual to look at, unusual sound, and really, I suppose, a real bird watcher's bird, because it's one that most people wouldn't be aware of at all. In some ways, it looks a bit like a giant moth. The plumage is really camouflaged. It's all sorts of browns and greys, and that's to so they'll blend in with leaf litter when they're or on branches as well when they're sleeping during the day, because as the name nightjar suggests, this is a bird that tends to be out at night, or indeed around dusk. It's the classic bird that we describe as being crepuscular, which means it's out at dawn and dusk in those low light levels, and its main food is moths. It has this enormous mouth that it uses just to scoop up moths when it's flying around, and it actually, I suppose, in some ways looks like a cross between a moth and a swift. That's how I describe it to someone. Same sort of body shape as a swift, same sort of big gaping mouth, and the two are actually related, but a good bit larger. A migrant species, they're only here in Ireland during the summer. A hard bird to survey. The sound is the main thing to listen out for. It really is, as you mentioned, you hear sometimes on soundtracks of TV programmes. You might not know there was a bird making it because it's really bizarre. It's quite unusual.
The sound is called churring, and let's listen to it.
That's quite otherworldly, isn't it?
It's weird, it's like something, you know, I don't know, you'd expect from Yabby Creek in Australia. It's not something you'd expect from sort of some forestry plantation down in Wexford or whatever. So really weird. But the another name for them is goatsucker, and which is because I don't know really where that came from. It's probably because they just appeared at nighttime and they have very strange sort of ecology.
Yeah, it's a name that goes back a long way. It goes back hundreds or even thousands of years. I think even in ancient Rome, it was known as the goat sucker. And it was believed that this bird at night would come and drink the milk directly from the teats of the goats in the fields. Now, that's complete nonsense. They wouldn't do that in a million years. But the fact is, perhaps, you know, they were found in that kind of habitat. I could certainly see them occurring in the kind of fields and pastures where goats might be wandering through the bushes and the trees, sort of like the Dehesa type of landscape you get in parts of Spain and Portugal today. Very similar. Nightjars tend to thrive in that kind of habitat. So maybe that's where it came from. But the name certainly stuck. So you still hear people calling them goat suckers today. But no, absolutely no attraction whatsoever to goats. They don't drink milk. They feed on insects. And a really remarkable bird. Also, showier than one might expect, because I remember once down in Wexford seeing one of the only breeding pairs in Ireland and seeing the male actually doing this display. He has these white patches near his wingtips. And he actually then sort of flashes those to attract the female and is supposed to intimidate other males. And he makes sort of clapping with his wings above his back. So it really is unusual that it's seemingly such a secretive bird would suddenly do this. And I also remember once in France, I was walking through a woodland, and nightjar wasn't even on my radar at the time. And all of a sudden, one flew out from underneath my foot in a woodland, and I saw on the ground a few eggs. And I realized, wow, a nightjar nest, just the edge of a woodland near some heath, that's where it was, sort of sandy soil. And I'd never been so close to one before. And the camouflage, I'm telling you, was astounding. You would not see this bird, completely invisible. And that's one of the reasons, again, why they're so hard to survey, because unlike a lot of birds, which will flush when a surveyor approaches, you see them immediately, the nightjars sit tight. You nearly have to step on them before they'll fly up, if they're with eggs or chicks, because the eggs and chicks are so precious to them, they'll only abandon them as a very last resort. So that was a real eye-opener for me, quite literally.
Yeah, no, I've never seen them in this country, but I was lucky enough to work for the RSPB in Suffolk, where there's a stronghold, and I used to really enjoy monitoring them there. An old Bill Oddie trick, I'm not sure if it's ethics and legality these days, but because of the flash of the male's white wings, sometimes sort of old British birders will take out two hankies and wave them in the air as kind of a threat to rival males, so hopefully that the bird would come closer to check them out or whatever. And the other one is you could do a light slap on the palm of your hand, it sounds like that, the wing slap of the bird as well. So they were old tricks that guys used to use, whether they were effective or not, I don't know.
Sounds to me like an excuse to go Morris dancing, Ricky.
That's it's a little bit Morris dancing, all right. Like for Rigouzel, for example, like big sort of remote valleys, what's happened up there that they're now disappearing from? Is it climate change? Is it what is it?
Well, a lot of it we don't fully know. Certainly climate change will be playing a role, because one of the reasons that the ringoozles would be up in those high mountain peaks and those scree slopes is because competing species of thrush can't get a foothold there. The conditions are just too harsh. There's too little amount of insects and worms and so on that birds like blackbirds would normally feed on. And that's not just here in Ireland. We're seeing that in places like the Pyrenees and the Alps, where these birds are birds of the high mountains. But what's been happening, as our climate warms, the climate zone moves up the mountains, and that means that birds like blackbirds and song thrushes and missel thrushes can creep therefore higher up the mountains and start to breed in those habitats. And it seems that the ringoozles can't compete with those birds. Once they come into the habitat, they dominate the ringoozles and they perish. There's no way for them to survive. So that may be part of it. The other thing that ringoozles have that separates them from our other breeding thrushes here in Ireland is that they're strongly migratory. So our other breeding thrushes, the blackbird, the song thrush and the missel thrush, they're here year round by and large, whereas the ringoozles are only here during the summer, and then they migrate to southern Europe and to North Africa for the winter. And when they're doing that, of course, they're more likely to come into contact with unsettled weather, difficult weather conditions, and they could be affected by all sorts of things there. It could be as well that hunting in some Mediterranean regions is having an effect on them too, because there's a big tradition of hunting thrushes in much of the Mediterranean region and in the Middle East as well. And a lot of those methods are really indiscriminate. They use sometimes lime sticks, which is horrible, type of glue that's sometimes put onto twigs. The birds perch on it and get stuck, or shooting a big flock of thrushes. And on migration, you will see these ringoozles mix in with other thrush flocks as well. So that may have be playing a role there too. Disturbance is another issue for them as well, as people are traipsing through sometimes their breeding grounds. That's pushed them into the more remote areas. But a lot of it we don't know. There's certainly a few things hitting them at once, and that's one of the reasons why a bird like this is so hard to save, because we can't fully pin down what's going wrong. It's been really sad to see the decline of that bird.
And I suppose nightjars, then you're looking at largely loss of habitat. I mean, heathland would be their key habitat, and over the years we've cleared it to improve it for farmland. We've overgrazed it with sheep, and then also afforestation is cuts in on a lot of that type of habitat as well. So they're kind of under just a bit of a squeeze, and probably the numbers were never probably massive anyway. So it's probably they've always been restricted to where those habitats are.
Yes, those habitats have always been fairly marginal here in Ireland. I often associate nightjars with heathland, but with kind of a sandy substrate nearby. Apparently one of the reasons why they like that is because it retains the heat, which means it's very good for moths. And one of the things that's a fact we have to face up to here in Ireland is that our insect populations have declined massively. There's nowhere near the big clouds of moths that you used to see in the Irish countryside. That's nightjar food. So it's no surprise they've declined from certain areas. But also, given Ireland's geographic location, for birds like the nightjar and the ringoozle too, we're the edge of their world. We're about pretty much as far west as they breed. And what you find when species start to decline, they usually retreat away from the edges towards the core of the range. So those birds remain relatively numerous in parts of their European strongholds where they're still breeding in good numbers, but they tend to retreat from the margins, such as Ireland. So that's another reason why they've been declining here. And it's another reason too why it's, you know, the likelihood of them recovering and coming back without a lot of assistance is less too, because those birds just aren't bothering to migrate to us anymore, and that's because they're migrants. So that's been an issue for them too. But probably a bird that's always been fairly marginal in Ireland, and strangely they're one that tends to benefit weirdly from clear felled conifer plantations for at least a short period of time. You know that's a place to look for them, where you see all the broken trees down in the sandy soil and the old heathland. That's where you find nightjars. But what happens is that habitat rarely survives for very long. It's quickly cleared or it's planted up again, and that habitat only maybe lasts for a few years at most. So that's no way to have a sustainable population. There's no sort of longevity to that habitat. So that's one of the reasons why the moths and the nightjars are declining, I'm afraid.
Next, I want to move to some species that are gone, some long gone, others not so long gone. So for two in particular I'd like to talk about. I'd like to talk about the bittern, which is probably gone since the early 19th century, if not before that even. And then the cornbunting, which is only gone within living memory, really.
Yes, two very tragic cases, and two though where hope isn't lost. Maybe something can be done here. Certainly with the bittern, it's again a really unique bird, one that a lot of listeners might not be familiar with. It was very well known in Irish folklore and tradition on Bunán Bui, the famous poem that many of us learned in school. That's the bittern, the yellow bittern. That's that species. It's a member of the heron family, and its whole life revolves around reed beds. They want to be in the heart of dense reed beds. They're camouflaged to look like reeds, and they have this amazing thing that they do when danger approaches. Rather than fly up or fly off, what they do is they freeze and point their beaks upwards to the sky, so their stripes on their plumage line up with the reeds and they become invisible. But they're quite a big bird. You know, like if you think of it, the size of a grey heron, they're more compact than that. The neck's not quite so long, but still a chunky bird with a similar sort of wingspan, but they rarely break cover. And the main way that they've been identified, particularly during the breeding season, is by their astonishing call or song, or whatever you want to call it. It's the booming of the bittern. It's a really, really deep sound. It's so deep that actually some speakers, playback speakers, can't actually go that low. It's almost as low as human hearing range can tolerate. It carries sometimes for over a kilometre in the right conditions, and it sounds to me like someone blowing over the top of a milk bottle. This really low resonant sound. Maybe we could hear that. Again, like the nightjar, you'd be forgiven for not understanding that it's a bird that's making that sound. And actually, a lot of the names of this bird in many languages, including in Latin, actually the scientific name, they refer to cattle and to the bull, because it sounds like the bellowing of a bull in the distance. So that's where the name comes from.
Well, yeah, I can well believe it. I remember hearing my first one in the UK and just being so excited. I mean, it's like, oh, the resonance of that sound, the percussion through it, it's they're amazing. And the I can vouch to say that they're so difficult to see. They're a bird of the reed edge, and they like sites with nice sort of, they like a topography of reeds. They don't like all old reeds, they don't like all young reeds, they don't like sort of all middle-aged reeds. So they'd like, traditionally in Ireland before and in the UK, when we used to harvest reeds for thatched roofs, it would have been perfect, because the reed beds would have had a lovely mosaic of freshly cut reeds, older reeds and sort of stuff like that. So there'd be nice channels for the bitterns to come and go to fish from and all that sort of stuff. But when they stick their head up in the sky and with that cryptic plumage amongst the reeds, they just melt into it. They're impossible. Really, really fascinating things. The last bittern I heard mention of in Ireland, Eric Dempsey had spotted sort of on his way down the motorway, landing in one of those, you know, those sort of motorway attenuation ponds that had, yep, sort of obviously got some reed mace or something, and it looked something sort of like home to a bittern for a few hours anyway.
Yes, I remember that. It was an amazing sighting. I drive past that particular pond quite a bit, and it's really small. It's quite close to Jack White's pub, if anyone knows that area. But again, it was just a one-off. Eric was really lucky to find that. And it's just by the side of the road. I suppose it just shows, actually, that if a bittern had to resort to that habitat, it just shows, I suppose, one of the reasons why this species has declined and disappeared from Ireland largely. It's because a lack of suitable habitat. So this bittern came in as a vagrant, was so exhausted, had to find somewhere. It had to settle for this little patch of reeds and water by the side of a motorway, which is really astonishing. And, you know, these big extensive reed beds, especially with that mixed mosaic of reeds of different ages and structures, they're really a thing of the past in a lot of Ireland. A lot of our wetlands have been drained. These big extensive reed beds have gone. You still have some of them in places like Tecumseh Lake in County Wexford, places like even parts of the Murrow Wetland Complex in Wicklow. There's still some quite extensive reed beds there and in parts of Cork as well. And we do sometimes in the winter occasionally get wintering bitterns in those reed beds. So the species does still occasionally occur here. So I take some heart from that and some comfort. We're still on the species radar. The bitterns are finding Ireland. And if the conditions can be returned to be suitable for breeding, perhaps they would they would stay after the winter and may go on to breed. But a lot of work needs to be done because our reed beds just aren't in the shape they need to be to support a species like that.
No, big extensive reed beds with loads of freshwater fish is what they need, and they need open water during the winter, so which shouldn't be a problem here really. So no, that's bitterns. They're fascinating, and hopefully they'll return on their own steam at some point, especially maybe there's potential in the Midlands bogs and through all that just transition stuff and everything. So hopefully, fingers crossed. The next guy definitely needs including, and sort of it's synonymous with the sort of the problems around agricultural intensification, and that's the good old corn bunting.
It is a very sad case, and the only songbird we know of in Ireland, the formerly bred here, that has become completely extinct in recent years. The last population died out on the Mullet Peninsula in the early 1990s. There was clinging on there, were pushed to the margins. But if you went back a couple of centuries, this would have been one of Ireland's most common and well-known widespread farmland birds. It's a bird that's very much associated with farmland, as the name would suggest. It kind of looks a bit like a chunky, muscular sparrow, I would describe it as. Sort of seed-eating beak, one of those conical beaks for crushing seed, kind of streaky brown bird. And I think that's one of the things that's maybe, I suppose, been to its detriment, because it's sometimes hard to get the general public and politicians and so on enthused about a little brown streaky bird that they might see as boring. Now, you and I would see it as anything but. It's a fascinating, amazing species and a real indicator of the health of a landscape. But it's certainly not, at first glance, as immediately charismatic as a puffin would be, or even a curlew. It's maybe not as visually interesting, it's a real shame that bird was let to dwindle and decline to the extent that it actually became extinct here. It remains quite common in parts of southern Europe. If you go to some of the plains of Spain, for example, you see them on every bush and every fence post. They have this amazing song. It sounds like someone jangling a bunch of keys. And what I find particularly sad, Ricky, is that this is a sound that would have once been synonymous with the Irish countryside. Our great grandparents and great great grandparents would have known this sound intimately, and it would have been just the soundtrack to their lives, and it's completely gone now. Like in most areas, the sound of the corncrake, a bird you would associate with the same sort of habitat. Very sad. Yeah, you hear that the jangling keys is a description. When I'm trying to think of bird songs or ways to describe them, I'm trying to think of something that makes it memorable. So certainly janglier than most other bird songs that you'd hear.
Yeah, no, it's really nice. I've never seen them here because they're not here. But in the UK, you used to see them in sort of rough corners of fields where there'd be arable weeds, and they'd be sort of perched on the likes of some sort of dry hogweed stem singing away, and really, really nice. And the males they're polygamous as well, so a male can serve a number of nests. I know that's a sort of a feature of their ecology that is interesting. And the males, they take no part in sort of the nesting side of things, but as soon as the chicks become mature, he kind of kicks back into gear and he says, I better feed these guys, and can be quite busy with two or three females or nests full of chicks to feed.
Yeah, that's quite an unusual strategy for a farmland bird, because in a lot of farmland bird species, the male tends to be much more hands-on or wings-on, maybe with the raising of the young and not spreading himself too thinly. But with the corn bunting, you're absolutely right. They tend to have this harem of females in an area, which is why the male spends so long singing, because his main strategy is to try and impress as many females as possible with the strength of his voice and how good he is at singing, because those females are impressed by this and they want their male offspring to inherit the ability to sing so well, so their genes will be passed on. This is the whole messaging that's going on when birds are singing. I think corn buntings are a great example of that. It would be lovely to hear that bird again in the Irish countryside, but it's pretty much certain that they wouldn't be able to recolonize by themselves. It requires some sort of reintroduction campaign. But we have to address the reasons why they went extinct in the first place, and that is a lack of habitat. As farming became more intensive and more mechanized, and as traditional tillage farming and hay meadow farming disappeared, there was no space left for the corn bunting. And that situation hasn't improved. If anything, it's got worse since the corn bunting disappeared from our landscape. So it really requires a full whole landscape change in order for that bird to be able to survive here again. Some people think that maybe it could survive still in places like the Mullet Peninsula on the margins again if it was reintroduced, but I'm not so sure myself, because that's where that was its last stronghold. It disappeared from there. One of the problems with small pockets of bird populations is they don't get any influx of genes from other populations, so they become very inbred, genetic weaknesses creep in and the populations disappear. And maybe that's what have ultimately put Page to the population on the Mullet Peninsula.
Yeah, and you can get sort of land abandonment, and then the land scrubs up, and then you no longer get those sort of weeds and arable crops that used to sort of sustain the species, and which is kind of the opposite to sort of if you go further east in the country where everything's just become sort of silage grassland and there's nothing left that way. So it's sort of striking that balance. Okay, that was the downer part of the episode. So we're going to move now to talk about some species that have returned, some maybe under their own steam and others with some help. So I don't know, we've got a few we can pick from. So tell me, this actually is a question I have. Previous to now, was there great spotted woodpeckers in this country? So is it a return or is it a colonization we're seeing now?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a matter of much debate. The position we have in Birdwatch Ireland is that there's no hard and fast categoric evidence that the grey spotted woodpecker as a species ever bred and occurred in Ireland before, other than as a rare vagrant. We know that sometimes birds in Scandinavia would turn up even in recent years before the recolonization happened, or colonization, or whatever you want to term it. Having said that, obviously, the historical record of these things is very sketchy and very piecemeal. And, hundreds of years ago, people didn't actually go to great lengths to write down a lot about our birds. So we don't fully know. Knowing that the species, the great spotted woodpecker, knowing it's so widespread and common across so much of Europe and Asia and North Africa, including some of the Canary Islands, it would stand to reason the species may well have been here when Ireland was pretty much coast to coast forests, and it would have been perfect habitat for them. Having said that, though, we don't have any concrete evidence that that was the case. There have been some remains found of them in areas, but there's a suspicion that may be down to human trade in the historic record, so we're not fully sure. But what is certain is that whether they're here or not before in big numbers, they are here now, and they are spreading across the country, and it looks like they're here to stay. So we can definitely say they are part of our Irish avifauna now, without question.
I think we could probably do a full episode on grey spotted woodpeckers at some point. Let's do that.
Oh, we would. We should talk to our colleague Dick Coombs there, Mr. Woodpecker. He knows more about them than anyone I know.
Excellent. That's what we'll do. We'll book him in. So two species that have arrived back under their own steam and very, very low density currently and shrouded in secrecy and everything because they're so vulnerable is the crane and the marsh harrier. Both have been sort of proven, have bred success. Well, actually, have the cranes been successful? Did they fledge?
They haven't. I know that certainly last year two chicks hatched, but they disappeared after a period of time. It's thought that maybe a predator like a fox may have got them, but at least they did hatch out. That's the first in a long time.
So in this country, a lot of people call grey herons cranes.
They do. It's a folk name that has stuck. So a lot of people still contact us saying, I've seen a crane in my local canal or whatever. I thought they were a rare bird. And I think what's happened is that the folk name or the memory has been transferred to the grey heron because, superficially at least, cranes and herons look very similar. They're not actually that closely related at all, but they're both very lanky, long-legged birds with long, long necks, long pointed dagger-like beaks and grey plumage. So they do look quite similar in many ways. But one good way to tell them apart is, big though a grey heron is, a crane is massive. It's way larger than a heron.
They're huge. And this pair is breeding somewhere sort of in the Midlands and up around Longford. And it's tremendous to see. And it's really good. Like, I mean, they feed on sort of roots and rhizomes in wetlands and fens and that sort of stuff. Like, there should be plenty of that up around there. And when the pumps go off on many of those bogs and they start to revegetate and stuff, there could be a lot of potential. It could be sort of big crane swamp up in certain parts of the Midlands if we let it happen.
Yes, that's right. And it's been good to see a lot of the re-wetting of these bogs that Bord na Mona has been carrying out, because this pair of cranes that has nested at this secret location, it is a re-wetted former cutaway bog. And although that obviously is it's a shame that so much of that habitat has been destroyed over the years, at least it's being restored to a habitat that now is clearly of great benefit to wildlife. And the fact that we have cranes now willing to come in there and attempt to nest, it bodes well for other species like the bittern that we're talking about earlier, because that same kind of re-wetted bogland habitat can support those great reed beds. And that's, so it does give me cause for optimism. Certainly the crane was a species that was mooted as a potential candidate for reintroduction. And I know reintroduction has happened in parts of England, for example, to some great success. But always with these things, if the species can manage to recolonize naturally, that's always better, because it tends to be more successful. The recolonization tends to take better, for want of a better word. So long may these cranes continue to try to breed there and succeed. Hopefully they'll manage to raise chicks successfully this year. And I know that the National Parks and Wildlife Service and Bord na Mona are urging people to not try track them down. Please don't go try work out where they are to take photographs of them. They really need to be undisturbed, because they're very prone to disturbance. They'll spot a human being from over a kilometre away and they freak out. So do give them a wide berth, please, if possible.
Yeah, I know it's tempting, but please, yeah, don't do it. I suppose the reason they disappeared from the landscape was reclamation of land and drainage and all the rest. And similar to the next species that I want to talk about, another raptor, bird of prey, is the marsh harrier.
Yes, a species that you find in fairly similar habitat. And again, a bird that's linked to the same sort of habitat as bitterns, particularly because they do like reed beds. So it's a species that it became extinct in Ireland as a breeder quite some time ago. But it was still a bird you could see here. They would turn up sometimes on migration. You'd see them passing through, or a vagrant return up. For example, several times in recent years at Birdwatch Ireland's East Coast Nature Reserve near Newcastle in County Wicklow, I've been watching from the main hide to see a marsh harrier drift over the reed beds, which is a real thrill. Now, we know they're not nesting there, but it was thought, well, if these birds are turning up here during the summer, because they're migrant species, they're really only here during the summer months, if they're turning back up again in Ireland during the summer, perhaps there's a chance they'll nest again. And I remember actually finding a marsh harrier nest, perhaps a dummy nest, wasn't actually used for nesting, but the birds had built it in the reed bed in the part of Tecumseh Lake a few years ago. Myself and my friend Stephen McAvoy were there. We stumbled across this and were astonished to find this nesting platform on the ground. So it looked like maybe they might be starting to come back and maybe think about nesting. And in recent years, we found out that they have. At secret locations, we're not going to reveal here, but marsh harrier is back breeding in Ireland. And it's great to see that species back now nesting here, heading in the right direction. I think that when you see large birds of prey returning to our countryside, it's a sign that actually some things are going right, because being apex predators at the top of the food chain, their presence in an area tells us a lot about the health of that overall environment. And a marsh harrier couldn't nest in an area unless there was plenty of food and other creatures there to support it. So I find that quite encouraging.
No, they're amazing, and they're obviously related to the hen harrier, so they do all the kind of similar traits. They do all that kind of sky dancing and displaying with the male and the female. They do food passes and lots of sort of flight aerobics, and amazing. And I used to do a lot of marsh harrier watches and surveys in the UK, and the male would sort of come along with a baby coot or something like that. He'd eat a lot of coots and small water birds like that, and he'd call the female off the nest, and she'd come up and grab the food, and they'd sort of dance around, and off she'd go back down to the chicks. It's really nice to watch, and it's one of the ways how you can identify where the nests are in an extensive reed bed, is to watch for those food passes. So it's they're thrilling. Let's listen to their call.
Yeah, a bird that it's hard to actually hear them that often. If you're near to the nest or something, if you're near one when it's flying past, you'll hear that sound. But mostly when they're in flight, they're kind of silent. But you do see that amazing sort of slow teetering flight that they have over the reed beds. We tend to think of birds of prey as being very fast and very rapid, like a peregrine falcon or something like that. And many are. But harriers tend to fly quite slowly. That's the secret of their success. So they sort of drift over the reeds, wings sort of held in a shallow V, teetering from side to side, carefully watching down below to try and see any prey like a coot or a water. water rail or maybe even a frog that might appear that they can grab. And indeed, they also have a sort of a facial disc on their face, a bit like an owl, not as developed as those on an owl, but that tells us they have very keen hearing as well. So that facial disc, it acts a bit like a satellite dish. It focuses the sound into their ears in the same way that it does on the face of an owl, and that helps it to pinpoint exactly where the prey is. And that's an important adaptation for a bird like a marsh harrier in dense reeds, where it can be very hard actually to see anything. At least they can hear where it might be. Just to think that you know, that species may now become a more regular and more common and widespread sight across Ireland, I think that's really heartening. Some places you go, like I've been bird watching quite a bit in the Netherlands, where they have lots of wetlands, and the marsh harrier is an abundant bird in the Netherlands. You see them all the time. I've been in wetland areas, you scan, you see four or five of them in one view. It'd be amazing to think that in Ireland maybe one day we can have that again here too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's all dependent on sort of our managing our wetlands and allowing them to occur naturally and all that sort of stuff. I mean, just the last three species we've spoken about, bitterns, cranes and marsh harriers, have disappeared because of land drainage and destruction, and which is crazy. So we need to sort of let our wetlands thrive and be dynamic and do what they do. So hopefully now in this next phase of just transition and all that lark, they're allowed to do that. And there's plenty, I think there's plenty of hope for the future for certainly large-scale wetlands in this country if we play our cards right.
Absolutely, Ricky. And I think that certainly the mindset towards wetlands is really changing. Maybe it needs to change a bit faster, but certainly heading in the right direction. Because not only are these wetlands so important for these birds and these charismatic species that we see, just think of all the other creatures that they benefit, all the different insects and other invertebrates that you find in them, like the moths and the butterflies and all of that. So when you see birds like marsh harriers returning, it's a sign that actually there must be some of these insects and other creatures returning as well. But not just that. We know that by re-wetting bogs and by cherishing our wetlands, that we're actually doing a huge amount to counteract climate change, because these absorb a huge amount of carbon from the atmosphere. And they're also a really important defence against flooding. We've seen a lot of flooding happening throughout Ireland. This is one of the consequences of climate change too. Flooding's become more unpredictable and erratic and more widespread and frequent. But obviously by having wetland areas that act as literal sinks for this water to go into and reed beds to absorb and to purify that water, the more wetlands we have, the lesser the effects of flooding will be. So I think that's a win-win for everybody. We need more wetlands. And when we start to see these birds returning to those wetland habitats and these reed beds, we know that we're at least taking steps in the right direction. So that's a lot of hope, I think, there, a lot of optimism.
100%. No, that's great. I think Niall will leave it on that very positive note.
Absolutely. And on positive notes as well, just to say, we really need your help. If you're listening to us here, we'd love your support in Birdwatch Ireland. We're a membership-based organisation. We're a charity. All the money we raise through our membership and donations goes to support our charitable work. You can find full details of that and other ways you can support us at birdwatchireland.ie. And please do spread the word. If you enjoy this podcast, please do let your friends and family know about it and direct them to it and direct them to our website. We'd really appreciate the support.
Thanks, Niall. The In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage. This podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.